Hello, my name is Craig Faust with Life Care Counseling, and you are listening to St. Louis Therapist Spotlight. And I am just going to meet with another fellow therapist that I know does good work and talk with them a little bit about their practice and their specialties. So if it's something that you feel like may be a good fit for you or someone that you know, then you may be able to get in contact with them. So without any further delay, here we go. Hello, my name is Craig, and I am here with Allie from Brave Steps Counseling. Allie, can you tell everyone hello?
Hi, it's good to be here. Thanks, Craig.
So I was hoping to just talk a little bit about your practice and your specialty. So first things first, can you just tell me a little bit about your practice? And really, I want to know about this name that you chose, the Brave Steps Counseling, and how does that play into the work that you do?
Absolutely. Yeah. So Brave Steps Counseling was kind of formed in my mind. I'm an anxiety therapist, and I specialize in working with folks with anxiety disorders, generalized anxiety disorder, social phobia, panic disorder, things like that. And obsessive compulsive disorder, body focused repetitive behaviors, and PTSD or trauma. And so as I thought about the clients that I work with, so many of them are so, so brave and taking these steps towards freedom from fear and freedom from the things that keep them wrapped up in their anxiety. And so Brave Steps just kind of seemed like the perfect name for the work that I do.
I'm going to be honest with you. I love that name and how it came about. So I want to talk a little bit about your focus with anxiety. And, you know, let's say that I am someone that is suffering from anxiety and I'm trying to decide if you might be a good fit for me. Give me an idea of, you know, maybe who's best served by coming to you, or like where they might be at in their journey on trying to, you know, manage their anxiety.
Yeah, so with the clients that I work with, you don't have to be 100% motivated. In fact, nobody ever has 100% motivation. It's as long as you just have a desire for things to be different and are willing to take little steps. You don't have to take giant leaps. One of the things that I think is important is just for therapists to meet their clients where they are. And so, you know, my goal is to work with you to look at the things that are holding you back from the life that you want, and to be able to come up with a plan together to you know, kind of walk on that path and, you know, taking those steps that may seem really scary. In fact, probably will seem really scary at times, but that, you know, you can do it at a pace that feels tolerable.
Okay. So on a very, like, maybe practical level, tell me about some of the techniques that you may use to, you know, help someone that's coming to see you for some of this anxiety work.
Yeah, so some of the things that we'll do are look at the beliefs that contribute to that anxiety, the things that, you know, maybe you have believed since you were little, or, you know, things like, everybody has to like me. I have to be perfect. I'm not good enough. Some of those things. And we'll begin to unpack, like, where that came from, and challenge some of those beliefs. Other things that we'll do are much more practical, behavioral things, like actually doing the things that are scary. So, for example, you know, I'm afraid of public speaking. So maybe I put myself in a situation where I have to give a 5-minute little spiel in front of some friends and, you know, be able to tolerate the anxiety that I feel, not fight it, but just notice it and realize that I can actually get through it and be okay.
So it seems like from what you're telling me that you actually deal with a wide scope of anxiety, and there is a piece where you're trying to examine like the history of it, like some of these beliefs that we have. But there's also this piece where you might encourage, or there might be some type of homework to kind of push actually into that spot to gain a little tolerance.
Absolutely. One of my clients came up with this quote. She actually has it in a painting that says, thinking will not overcome fear, but action will. And I think that just kind of encapsulates what I do here. Like, we can think and think and think all day long and stay stuck, but it's taking those really brave steps at a pace that feels okay, that gets us moving forward and challenging those fears.
I love that that quote, because it's a lot of times the thinking with anxiety that starts to get us really paralyzed.
Yes.
So I'm kind of wondering, I know that you said that one of the things, you work with anxiety, but you also work with PTSD. Do some of the techniques that you use or some of the modalities overlap with one another?
They do. You know, one of the things that I found to be incredibly helpful with PTSD is a therapy called EMDR, or eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. It's kind of a mouthful, so we use the acronym.
EMDR is a lot easier to say.
It is. And basically, to really kind of simplify that, it's looking at examining the traumatic event from the past while also staying in the present. And so it uses a technique that mimics the eye movements that we do when we sleep and dream in REM sleep. And we've learned that that's how the brain processes information just from the day. It's why our dreams are so crazy sometimes. Okay. And but we found that in activating that process in the brain actually can heal on its own. It's quite fascinating. And people are able to revise the negative beliefs that were formed during the trauma, things like it was my fault, or, you know, things like that, I have to be perfect, those kinds of things. They're able to spontaneously revise those through this processing.
So those beliefs that you're talking about, whenever you're doing EMDR, is that why you might start out looking for the beliefs?
Yes.
So that then you can use it for EMDR?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, I know there's a couple different ways that people may do EMDR. Like, I know there's like different light bars or like tapping or tappers, I think, that some people use. What do you do?
I do not use a light bar. I do use my fingers for the eye movements. Mm-hmm. Just have almost like the eye doctor will have you follow their fingers. It's similar to that. And then I also have tappers, and mm-hmm. I have headphones if we want to use sounds for that bilateral stimulation.
Okay, that bilateral stimulation. Can you tell me a little more about that? Like, how does that relate to this?
Right. So with both the tappers and with the headphones, with the headphones, there will be a sound. With the tappers, there will just a slight little buzz that will go in the right side and then the left side and then the right side and the left mm-hmm. side. So it's drawing your attention to both sides in a bilateral or both sides kind of way. And so similar to the eye movements where you're moving your eyes back and forth from right to left, similar once again to REM sleep.
Okay. I'm kind of curious. Do you ever use EMDR with those that suffer from anxiety that may not exactly have PTSD symptoms or anything like that, or may not exhibit those?
There's definitely a lot of research behind that is effective. Really for me, I look at it on a case-by-case basis to see mm-hmm. what form of therapy is going to be most effective for each client and for, you know, the specific issues that they're working with. But that is something that I have available to me to use if it's going to be helpful for them.
Okay. So I kind of wonder, let's say that like I'm someone that's coming to see you for anxiety. And I probably suffered from this for quite some time. And give me some type of idea. You said you may start out with exploring some of these beliefs, and then from there you may decide, like, you know, EMDR, what are some other choices that you may have, just depending on, you know, what may be happening with me?
Right. So, you know, for some folks it's going to look more like a cognitive behavioral, let's look at the beliefs, let's, you know, challenge them in the sense of, like, you know, is this a distorted belief, and is there evidence to support this belief, or is it, you know, something that you can challenge in some ways, and then beginning to shift the behaviors mm-hmm. so that, you know, for example, I you know, like if it's like a social anxiety type of thing where I will be rejected if I, you know, go to this party. Well, the problem is you might actually be rejected if you go to the party. Mm. That's not the core issue, even though it feels like it is. What's the core issue is can I tolerate that, you know, if someone rejects me, you know, am I going to be okay? Is there enough strength internally to feel okay about myself if everyone doesn't love me?
So being able to take some of these thoughts and almost look behind the curtains and see what may actually be there. And,
exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So you said that that's more of a cognitive behavioral approach.
Yes.
I wonder, can you tell me just a little bit about that so that, you know, potential client may even know about that?
Right. So cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, has been around for decades. And basically the idea behind it is looking at our cognitions or our thoughts and how those impact our behaviors and our emotions and our feelings and the meaning that we make from different situations and things that have impacted us.
Seems to be right up the alley of someone that has anxiety.
Yes.
You know, I'm kind of curious, this, even while we're here talking about how you may work with those that have anxiety, what's it like for you just kind of even sitting across some of these people that you're working with and seeing them go through and making these brave steps forward?
It's really inspiring. You know, it's, I get so excited when I see clients that have been just bound by their fears. I mean, there's some folks who, you know, their anxiety is so great that their world is just has shrunk. You know, they can barely leave their house, or you know, they're very limited in the things that they can do. And so to see someone really pushing back against that and stepping into life, and you know, their whole being just becomes more alive, and that's really, really exciting.
You know, it sounds magical, even the way that you say it, like their being comes alive. I wonder for you, I know that you said that you work with anxiety and you work with phobias, and I feel like for phobias, that's almost like I don't want to say a step up or anything, but that sounds a lot more specific a lot of times than some of the anxiety. So can you give me a little bit of a sense of what it's like whenever you work with someone that has a phobia as opposed to someone that may have anxiety, or if I'm curious if I have a phobia as opposed to anxiety?
Right. And so with phobias, I'm going to use a therapy that's called exposure and response prevention. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, like I said, there's always exceptions, but for the most part, that's where I'm going to go with that. And the idea behind that is we create a hierarchy. So for example, if you have a phobia of dogs, mm-hmm. and let's just say for the example, there's no trauma history with this, but you just for whatever reason have a phobia of dogs, we're going to work together to create a hierarchy that then we can use to do exposure work. So for example, maybe on the low end of that hierarchy, it will be reading an article about a dog. Or looking at a picture of a dog, maybe then moving up, watching a TV show that has a dog in it, you know, visiting a friend that has a dog that is not as threatening to you as other breeds, you know, that kind of thing. And eventually working up to whatever is at the top of your hierarchy.
Okay. So even in those moments, that's reflective of the name, right? Taking the brave steps, even in those moments, starting with something that's maybe lower on that like threat hierarchy and then slowly working your way up. So actually gaining a tolerance that whole time.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that is really the goal. I wish that there was a way to like magically remove all anxiety. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately anxiety, well, I say unfortunately, anxiety is not good or bad. It is there to almost like the dashboards on our car. It's there to alert us to something. Mm-hmm. And so the goal in doing anxiety therapy, though, is to be able to understand more where it's coming from and to be able to tolerate it, knowing that it's not actually harmful to us.
Okay. Okay. So if I'm a potential client listening to this and some of the things I'm hearing sounds good, But I'm really just not quite sure if you might be a good fit for me. Tell me just a little bit about like some of the clients that you work with that you feel like they do the best type of work with you. Like what kind of mindset would I need to be in, or what type of, I don't want to say like what type of like personality would I have that you know, like you just really click really well with?
You know, I think the clients that are, I click really well with, so to speak, are the ones that are just ready for something different. They're ready to take a step. And like I said, it can be a tiny step. It doesn't have to be, you know, I'm going to go out and adopt a dog, you know, from the Humane Society. Like, no, it's just, you know, ones that are like, okay, the avoidance that I've had or the other coping skills that I've used to manage my anxiety, just it's not working anymore and I'm ready to do something and I need that support.
Okay. So someone that may have been in this place for a little bit and they're just like, all right, I'm done avoiding this. I love that you use that word. I'm done avoiding this. I'm ready to start trying to take some of those steps. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You said something important there, and I just know that a big word that's used a lot of times whenever people have anxiety is like coping skills. And I'm kind of wondering, like, where does that fit into the work that you do? Or is that something where it doesn't really come into play here because maybe people already have coping skills by the time they come to you? Or like maybe it's not really as effective. Just give me an idea for you. Where do coping skills fall whenever you do anxiety work?
So I think coping skills are really important. Like I said, you know, anxiety is not going anywhere in the sense of there's always going to be things in this world that cause anxiety. And so it's how do you manage it? And learning adaptive coping skills or coping skills that are going to be effective in allowing you to do the things that are important to you and tolerate the, you know, discomfort that anxiety brings, momentary discomfort that anxiety brings. And so things like relaxation, deep breathing are important at the beginning just to learn that, like, I don't have to be tense and anxious all the time.
I get that. Don't have to be tense and anxious all the time. This isn't how life has to be.
Yeah.
Like, there's a different way.
Right.
You know, another thing while I have you here that I want to talk about that you mentioned earlier was talking about the work that you do with OCD. Can you tell me just a little bit about that? Or, you know, maybe even before we get into that, let's say that I'm wondering if I have OCD. What are some of the symptoms I might notice, or what are some of the things that may be happening to me?
That is a great question, because OCD is one of those things that a lot of people are misdiagnosed with, and they can go to therapists or they can go throughout life. And for some folks, it's, you know, 10 plus years of struggling before they get an accurate diagnosis and a therapist who knows how to treat it. Mm-hmm. So with OCD, there are the obsessions. Unwanted intrusive thoughts, images, impulses that come into your mind that are distressing. There are also compulsions or rituals, behaviors that you do in order to neutralize or reduce the distress of those obsessions. And then the disorder part, so it's OCD. So the D part is this is taking up a lot of time for you, like at least an hour a day. This is disrupting your life. Mm-hmm. You know, I think in our culture, a lot of people will say, you know, oh, I'm so OCD because I like my house to be neat, or, you know, I color code things. And that's actually not necessarily OCD because it's not distressing.
Yeah. Like if it bothered you if it wasn't color coded, or if things weren't exactly placed in the order that they're supposed to, like you have to stop what you're doing to...
Right. You stop what you're doing and maybe you do it again and again and again because you're just not sure if it's actually done or done right. In French, the term for OCD is translated the doubting disease because there's always the question in your head of, wait, did I really do that? Did I do it right? Is it okay? And if I don't do it, what will happen? So this is another key piece with OCD is so often that I have to turn my light switch on and off a certain number of times, or else, you know, a family member might die. So it's not always completely rational. And when you try to approach OCD with just a traditional cognitive behavioral therapy that tries to make it rational, it doesn't work. And so that is why exposure and response prevention, or ERP, is the gold standard for OCD, because you have to really put yourself in those situations. The exposure challenges the obsession part, and then the response prevention challenges the compulsion. So for example, if I struggle with contamination OCD, so I'm afraid of germs, and the germs are going to harm me, harm my loved ones, I have to touch things like, let's say, a doorknob, and then not wash my hands or use hand sanitizer, which once again, we set up a hierarchy. We don't necessarily start with that. But the goal is to have freedom so that I can touch doorknobs.
Yeah. Or at least increase the tolerance so that if you touch it, you don't have to immediately go and wash your hands. Maybe you can wait a little bit and then a little bit longer.
Exactly, yes.
Okay. So it is similar to the exposure that you might have with certain phobias.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I get the exposure part. Tell me a little bit about like the thought process part, or like how you might look at that.
Look at the setting up the exposures or the response prevention part?
Sorry, the response prevention part.
Okay, yeah. And I'm going to kind of go on a fun little side note, because with the rituals or the compulsions, they are not always behavioral or outward. So for example, maybe I can do the hard thing, I can do the exposure, but then I neutralize it in my mind by saying, you know, reassuring myself, saying it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, or saying a prayer or counting in my head, or maybe tapping or doing something like that, which is also a ritual that then neutralizes that exposure.
Okay. Okay. So those rituals that, and that's really what you're aiming for, is to try to create those new rituals that may neutralize that. Is that what you're saying, or
actually no, the
I'm
goal
saying, you're saying the opposite.
The opposite, yes. The goal is to be able to do an exposure without using the rituals. That's the response prevention part in the ERP.
Okay.
It's which really gives you that freedom that so many of my clients long for, to be able to do life without having to then compensate in some way.
I think you're definitely right as far as OCD being, I think it's a catch-all term that gets used in our society. I think we see it so often that it becomes really easy. Now, I know that with OCD that I wonder, do you see a lot of overlap with anxiety with the OCD then?
Yes.
Because of those, that compulsion? And
yes, there's definitely a strong anxiety component in OCD. In fact, in the past, OCD was listed as an anxiety disorder. It has since been separated out, and it's its own category now. But there is definitely a lot of overlap.
Now, do you find that those that may suffer from OCD, if they are successful in reducing the, you know, severeness or that compulsive part, or like even any of those rituals like you're talking about before, that they're successful in doing that, does that anxiety a lot of time go away, or is that something that sometimes needs to be addressed separately, or does it just depend case by case?
You know, I think it definitely diminishes, because one of the goals of ERP is to habituate to that anxiety. Mm-hmm. And one of the examples I often use is like if folks, you know, let's say it's a hot summer day and you jump into a pool and you're initially like the water's freezing, and then, you know, you stay in the water and a few minutes later you're like, oh my gosh, the water feels great. That's the body's natural way of habituating to it. Yeah. And in a very similar way in doing ERP, so you do the exposure, you challenge the rituals, and the brain is able to habituate to that anxiety. So what maybe felt like, you know, an 8, 9, or 10 on a 10-point scale in terms of anxiety, maybe now is down to like a 3 or 4.
I can only imagine for someone that has suffered from OCD or even anxiety or maybe even PTSD, that once they're in a place where they're not worried about that, or that's not kind of looming in the background all the time, how much more energy that they would have from not constantly having this peace just in the background, or maybe even in the foreground, depending on what it is.
Absolutely. There's so much more, you know, physical as well as emotional energy and mental energy. And, you know, folks have made, you know, great progress in really challenging their OCD have found they actually have the energy and desire to, you know, go back to school or get a different job or just, you know, be much more involved in their friends and their family's lives.
Okay. I think that even just going back to one of the things that you say that you really love seeing in your clients, you said the coming alive part. Mm-hmm. I just imagine that those two have to be connected. I mean, I can only imagine the amount of energy that it takes to try to keep this contained all the time. Or like you said, even with OCD, the amount of sheer time that it takes just out of your daily life. I mean, I have 24 hours and it's hard enough for me to get everything done. I can only imagine if I have, you know, less than that, because right. all this, because of this condition that I have is stealing that time away from me.
I love the way you phrase that, because that's, mm-hmm. yes, it's stealing that time.
Mm-hmm. I like the way that you've explained it. It kind of gives me like the OCD isn't always a part of who we are. It's like something that's afflicted us in some way.
Yes.
Now, and I'm kind of wondering, I know that I've heard before with OCD that sometimes talking about it or paying more attention to it can sometimes make it worse. And I'm kind of wondering, are there any thoughts on that? Or like whenever you do different type of work in here, well, what is it that work in here may do even just to address that kind of thing?
Right. And so one of the things that can actually make OCD worse is really trying to stop the thoughts. So, you know, there, I want to say that I think contamination OCD gets the most press, but there are lots of different forms that OCD can take. Mm-hmm. And so it can be like checking rituals. It can also be something called harm OCD, where, you know, maybe I have these thoughts or images that pop into my mind where I'm going to harm someone that I love. This is different than like homicidal or suicidal thoughts. Mm-hmm. These are distressing to me. I don't want to, but these thoughts come into my mind and then I have to do something to neutralize them. Or maybe even like sexual thoughts, or, you know, things that, once again, it's repulsive to me. It's inappropriate. And I know that, but I can't not think them. And so mm-hmm. then just don't think about it. Well, now it's like, don't think about a pink elephant. That's all you can think about. And so, yeah, it's some forms of therapy can actually make it worse.
So like you said, that's whenever that assessment piece and making sure, or I'm interpreting that, that's whenever you said that making sure that that's the correct diagnosis.
Yes.
Is so important.
Yes.
Which actually led me to what I wanted to ask you about. So like, what does, do you have an assessment process or anything? Like if someone's coming in here for their first visit, what can they expect from that first visit with you?
So from the first visit, I'm going to talk to them. I'm going to get some history, going mm-hmm. to look at, you know, what they're struggling with, whether it's, you know, anxiety, you know, obsessive thoughts, rituals, you know, if there are trauma symptoms, things like that. There are different assessments that I use. At times I don't use them for each client every time, mm-hmm. but one of the more common assessments that I use for OCD would be like the obsessive compulsive checklist, or the Yale Brown obsessive compulsive scales, or the Y-box as it's called, you know, things like that that can look at assessing the severity of it.
Okay. All right. I'm kind of wondering, even just while we're sitting here, if there is someone that's listening to this that may have anxiety or OCD or PTSD or have a phobia, is there anything that you would like them to know about their condition, or something that may be important for them just even while they're dealing with it right now?
You know, the thing that comes to mind as you ask that question is just the role of avoidance. For most people, if something is scary, then the natural thing is to avoid it. And then my fear or my anxiety goes down. The problem with that is that while it temporarily goes down, the next time I am confronted with that thing, whatever it is, my brain has learned that it is dangerous and it should be avoided. And so now my anxiety is even higher than it was before. So now you have more anxiety and your world is beginning to shrink because of the avoidance.
Okay, that makes good sense. So the more and more that we avoid something, it can actually make it more intense, especially if we do it often.
Exactly.
Or I'd imagine that the avoidance is really severe. Like we put a lot of effort into avoiding whatever it may be. Okay. That makes good sense. I'm just wondering, even while we're here, I know that if I'm someone that is maybe even just a typical person, or which I think a lot of typical people suffer from anxiety, but let's say that I'm like, hey, I like this Brave Steps Counseling. I want to work with Allie, and I set up an appointment with you, and I end up coming here. Can you just tell me a little bit about where you're located and how I might find you?
Absolutely. So my office is in Baldwin on Manchester Road. We're about a little over a mile west of 141 on Manchester. And the easiest way to contact me is to go to my website, bravestepscounseling.com. And from there, you can click on the button that says contact me. That sends me an email, or you can call me. The number is 314-527-0846. And leave me a voicemail and I will get back in touch with you and get you scheduled.
All right. That sounds perfect. Allie, thank you for all the work that you do.
Thanks so much, Craig.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of St. Louis Therapist Spotlight. The music that you're listening to is called Lobby Time by Kevin McLeod, and that is licensed under Creative Commons. And you can find more great tunes like this at creativecommons.org.